I'd like now to welcome Hannah Nordhaus. She is award-winning journalist, author of the book The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this one man in the title of your book and the subtitle is John Miller. Who is he and how did you come to spend so much time with him and write a book about him and his livelihood, namely beekeeping?
Well, John Miller is a fourth generation migratory beekeeper. He has been keeping bees his whole life, as did his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather before him. So he's got a long tradition as a beekeeper, and he has 10,000 beehives, and he drags them all over the West, pollinating crops and making honey. And in recent years, he's really struggled to keep his bees alive. I'm sure that most people now know that there's been a problem with the honeybees dying off. And so the book's really about this guy and this struggle to save his career and these bees that he just loves for reasons that nobody quite understands.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing and compelling character. There's so much about bees that I want to talk about with you. I mean, the fact that honeybees are important as pollinators, you need bees in order to basically have a food supply. But what I didn't know was that this process of pollinating basically no longer occurs naturally.
Not at the scale that we need it to for modern agriculture. You know, basically, most farms are now huge, and a lot of them are single crop farms, and a lot of these crops need pollination, and this is something that once happened without, you know, anybody noticing. But now that it's, you know, acres and acres of one crop that only blooms for 3 weeks, it's not a sustainable place for a pollinator, especially a bee, to live. So there's pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides that are sprayed, and there's nothing else for bees to eat except for what's blooming at that current moment. So the minute the bloom's over and the apple blossoms fall or the almond blossoms, there's nothing for bees to eat. So you really have to get them out of there and move them on to the next place. So they've really, you know, what used to happen just without anybody noticing now is just a part of the agricultural system where you have to truck bees in and make it happen.
John Miller brings his bees to almond tree plantations, and you write quite a bit about that in the book. Tell us what that is like.
Yeah, so almonds are like basically the center of a commercial beekeeper's life these days. The almonds bloom in February for about 3 weeks, and they cannot pollinate themselves, and their pollen is too heavy to be pollinated on the wind, so they need pollinators. And if a bee visits an acre of almonds, it'll produce about 40 pounds. If it doesn't visit an acre of almonds, I should say, it will produce about 40 pounds of almonds. If a bee is there to pollinate it, it'll be about 3,000 pounds. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge difference. And, you know, basically, you know, in addition to irrigation and, you know, all the other factors that make a crop happen, pollination for almonds is essential. And in recent years, as bees have struggled and as the almond crop has done really well, it's really boomed, the rental fee for a hive of bees has increased dramatically. So it's now about $150 per hive for beekeepers to bring their hives in and pollinate the almonds. And it basically, for John Miller and his, you know, the other guys, there's probably about 1,000 of these migratory beekeepers. It is the way they make a living. It's really hard to make money from honey these days, so pollination is it. So he makes all of his profit in about 3 weeks in February pollinating these almonds.
And this means coming in with gigantic semi-trucks and forklifts and carrying pallets of bees and sticking them on the ground near but not too near the almond trees.
Yeah, so in starting in late January, they, you know, get all their bees out. They actually keep them in potato cellars in Idaho from November to January to keep them in a dormant state. They pull them out of the potato cellars. They bring them in to California. They, you know, sort them all out. They bring them in. So he's got the 10,000 hives. He does 500 hives per semi, trucks them in to the almond orchards, and then he has to place them. It's about two hives per acre. And, yeah, they don't put them in the middle of the almond rows. They put them on the end so that they don't get, you know, caught up with all the machines and they don't get sprayed by the irrigators. And there's a science to all of this, you know, how you plant your almond trees. They lean them slightly to the northwest against the prevailing winds. And, you know, they have this very precise diamond grid. And where they place the hives is part of that science. And so And then they have to, you know, they leave them in there, and then they have to get them out immediately once the bloom's done, before the bees get sprayed and they lose them all.
And then the bees go on to the next thing. And as you write, there is, I don't know if it's really manifested yet, but there's a potential danger in basically using bees as a kind of migrant slave labor that you're bringing from one place to another. It's not their natural cycle at all.
No, it's, I compare them in the book to you know, conscripts, or, you know, it's sort of army ships or slave ships. They're trucked around, particularly the almond orchard. So there's 750,000 acres of almonds planted in the Central Valley of California. It's the only place in the world that almonds can grow like that. And so they have to bring 2/3 of the nation's bees into the almonds to pollinate them. And they come from all over the country. It's about 1.5 million hives. And they're all stuck together. You know, it's also been described as a brothel. They're in there. John Miller describes it as swapping spit. You know, they're all the bees from all the places that they came with all the diseases that they brought are trading all sorts of pathogens. And then, you know, they're plunked back onto their truck, which, you know, you compare to a slave ship, and brought to the next place. And it's a tough, it's really hard on the bees. It's, you know, they're woken up early from their winter dormancy. They're jostled, and it's, you know, traveling on trucks is very hard for them. They're brought to a place, there's nothing blooming. They fed sugar water and or corn syrup and pollen patties, which are these, you know, these little sort of pancakes they put on top of the hives. And then they work really hard when the bloom happens, and they're crammed into, you know, there's more bees per acre than there would be naturally, obviously. And then the blooms drop off. There's nothing to eat for them again. It's a desert, basically, and then they're trucked off to the next place. So it's really an unnatural life cycle. And the beekeepers know it. They're not thrilled about the way it works, but it's the only way they have been able to figure out how to make a living.
There are a lot of challenges to bees, especially in the last 25 years, as you describe it in this book, and one of them is mites. There are these little tick-like things that sit on bees, and they just have devastated bee populations almost everywhere in the world.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people have heard about colony collapse disorder, which is the thing that sort of cropped up in the last 5 years where the honeybees have just disappeared. But if you ask John Miller, he would say his biggest challenge is this little nasty parasite called the varroa mite, which is, it's this sort of reddish-brown, it's about the size of the head of a pin, and it looks like an itty-bitty little tick. And, you know, if once you know what it's capable of, it just has an evil look to it. And so these mites arrived in the U.S. in 1987, after they had already sort of worked their way through Europe and South America and, you know, wreaked havoc and devastation on all the apiaries wherever they were found. They were originally, they co-evolved with the Asian honeybee, and at some point, because, you know, the European honeybee, which is a lot more productive than the Asian honeybee, has spread around the world, and at some point the European honeybee and the Asian honeybees met, they think in Siberia, and the mite jumped from the Asian bee to the European bee, but did a lot more damage on the European bee, and then it sort of worked its way through Russia, Europe, and finally to the U.S. So it hit the U.S. in the late 80s, and by the early 90s it had spread all the way across the country. And for a long time, they were able to control it with miticides, with little, you know, medicine sticks they put in there. And this was, again, something beekeepers weren't thrilled about because it's the first time they've used chemicals in their hive, particularly.
And they hate pesticides because they kill bees.
Yeah, I mean, pesticides are things that they are, that beekeepers are ingrained to hate, and suddenly they're using them. So that worked for a while, but this mite is a very clever little creature, and it developed a resistance to the first one of the pesticides they were using, and then a second one. And the second one was actually a lot harder on the bees, so it, you know, things were going downhill anyhow. They were, you know, their queens were failing. It was just a lot tougher to keep their bees alive. And then in about 2004, they developed a resistance. And John Miller that year, that was right when I met him, he lost about 40% of his bees to all variety of virus is vectored by this varroa mite, and since then, it's, you know, his life is just an eternal struggle to try to find ways to keep these mites under control.
There are some possible solutions. Pesticides, except the problem with pesticides that get rid of these mites is that they just develop resistant strains, which is why the first pesticide, which was great, stopped working. But also, trying to breed a resistant strain of bees that is less vulnerable to these mites. Has there been any success in that?
Some. They're making progress. There's a woman named Marla Spivak who's fantastic entomologist. She won the MacArthur Genius Grant last year, and she's been working on developing called hygienic bees, that bees that detect diseases in the hive and clean out the diseased bees. And she's had some success, and those bees tend to be more resistant to the mites. The problem is that once you get these bees out of the lab and out of their sort of home range and into the sort of global bee commons and in the almond orchards, where it's just, you know, where the bees are weakened already and then so susceptible to all these viruses, it's hard. Even resistant bees, when they get moved and are exposed to new viruses and ticks and whatnot, they still succumb to these things. So so she's actually doing this great work trying to teach beekeepers how to raise their own local bees that are hygienic. And she's, I mean, I watched her. She works with queen breeders, teaching them how to apply liquid nitrogen to part of the hive, and the brood, the baby bees, die off. And then if the bees then clean them out, then that's a hygienic bee, and so then you want to select for that. So you keep those queens and you breed them, and you keep that line going. And if the bees don't care, if there's dead bees inside their hive, then you don't want those bees to be, you know, to represent the future. So she's doing some really good work, and it's coming along, but it's not there yet. There's also in this since my book has come out, they've discovered a new material that works, that helps with varroamites. It's a formic acid, which people have been using, but it's really hard to use. It's very volatile, and if you use it wrong, you're puking blood in the bee yard and that sort of thing. And there's
new... Yeah, it's bad for people. Yeah. I mean, forget about bees.
Yeah, and there's a new formulation that apparently that John Miller is really excited about that works a lot better, and it's not a pesticide, so they won't develop resistance. So he has great hope for that, although I think this year he hasn't, you know, it hasn't gotten any better than in previous years. So they're, you know, they're trying, and we're just hoping that, you know, somebody will find some sort of magic bullet bee or material that'll make life like it used to be for beekeepers, when you could just leave your hive and forget about it.
Right. We're talking to Hannah Nordhaus about her book, The Beekeeper's Lament. Now, let's talk for a moment about colony collapse disorder. First of all, what does it look like to the beekeeper?
Well, what tends to happen is a beekeeper comes and comes to check his hive, and he finds all his bees gone. You know, the queen's still there. She looks perfectly healthy. She's laying eggs in a very healthy pattern. There's lots of brood, which are the developing bees, larvae and pupae and the baby bees. And there's a few attendants who take care of the queen that don't go out and forage. But all the foragers have disappeared. And there's lots of honey, too. So it's not an unhealthy hive. It's a healthy hive in which all the adult bees have fled. So, it really captured the national imagination, because it was such a eerie sight.
And nobody knew where they went.
No, yeah. They just,
it wasn't like there was a pile of dead bees half a mile away.
Yeah, they flew off. They went far from the hive and presumably died. At some point, they definitely died. Beekeepers had not seen this before. And it was really weird. And this guy, Dave Hackenberg, a Pennsylvania beekeeper, first noticed it in some bees he was keeping in Florida in, I think it was November of 2006. And by 2007, it was sort of a full-flown epidemic. It was all over the country, and nobody could figure out what was going on. The bees, you know, if you autopsied the bees, all their internal organs were blackened and necrotic. But it was also very hard to autopsy bees because the sick ones had all flown off. And that year and the next, about 30% of the nation's bees died from that disorder. And, you know, some guys, I think Dave Hackenberg, the one who first discovered it, lost about 90% of his bees. So it was really quite dramatic. And they're still trying to figure out what causes it.
Yeah, I mean, I know there have been various hypotheses, including cell phones and stuff like that, but that's kind of been dismissed.
Yeah, for people who know beekeepers, the cell phone one never really held water, because first of all, they have a lot of remote bee yards in which they don't get cell service, and you know, if you heard how much they complain about that, there's been one study that recently came out. There was sort of a big hubbub in the news that this guy found that that cell phones disturb bees, when I actually went in and read about the study, it was, you know, he had put a cell phone inside the hive and made it ring. And, you know, and then the evidence
right.
was that bees were disturbed for 12 hours after. You know, if I had a cell phone under my pillow ringing, it would disturb me, too. So I haven't never bought into that, and there's not been any studies that have suggested that that's really a compelling case. You know, the other more dramatic suggestions are, you know, the rapture that the bees are, you know. First the bees go, and then the rest of us go. But, you know, more convincing arguments are pesticides. A lot of people feel very strongly that pesticides are part of the problem, particularly a new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which are systemic insecticides that, you know, are throughout the whole plant. And, you know, the arguments are quite convincing for neonicotinoids. Unfortunately, none of the science yet, and people will disagree with me about this, but my reading from what I've looked at, none of the science has backed that up in a convincing way. And what people are finding, you know, all these studies suggest, oh, well, you know, bees are succumbing to this virus or that fungus or this pesticide. But, you know, it's you don't really know what, you know, that healthy bees have a lot of these things too. So they haven't quite established a baseline for what is a healthy bee and what's an unhealthy bee. You know, what a lot of scientists think is happening now is a combination of a fungus called Nosema, which has been around for a long time, but there's a new variant that's come in from China that seems to be a little bit more virulent and works at different times of year. And that alone doesn't seem to be correlated with CCD, but that in conjunction with other viruses does. But, you know, in another month there'll probably be another study out suggesting it's something else. So there's been nothing there's no smoking gun at all. They can't figure it out. John Miller describes it, you know, his theory is that it's death by a thousand paper cuts. It's sort
right.
of the all the insults of beekeeping, the long distance travel, the unnormal schedule, the all these viruses and fungi and pests, varroa mite, they're coming through. And they're also beginning to think nutrition has a big factor. This seems sort of monocrop diet going from one crop to the next. And, you know, the crops are, you know, have had things, a lot of them sprayed on them, and that they don't have a varied diet and they're not getting, you know, enough pollen and that sort of thing. And that may be a factor as well.
Reading your book, I kept thinking, I mean, I think especially around here in Santa Fe where we talk about eating locally and having sustainable agriculture and small closed-loop farms and things like that. But I was thinking, well, first of all, you know, almonds. These almond monocrops are a form of insanity, but they provide the almonds that I eat all the time. I eat almonds probably every day of my life, cheaply. If we were to try to go back as a country to a different way of farming, small-scale farming, you can't go back. I mean, the world's wild honeybees, the nation's wild honeybees, are gone.
Yeah, you... I mean, people will argue with us about that. I sort of think, you know, this is the system we have. It's not ideal. It can be improved. I, you know, devoutly hope it will be improved. But it is not going to, you know, if a bunch of good-minded people from Santa Fe and Boulder, where I live, and, you know, go out and start organic farms that, you know, with diverse crops, and it's not going to feed us the way we expect to be fed, not to mention, you know, the developing world and the 7 billion people population of the world. So we are sort of stuck with this system, and I do hope that we find ways to improve it, and I do think that there is a role for these smaller, more diverse organic farms. But yeah, it's you know, the system has developed, and these big crops have killed off all the wild pollinators. You know, honeybees were never native to the U.S., so there are no such thing as wild honeybees in North America, but there were a lot of feral bees that came over, you know, starting from with the colonists, and that played a role in farm pollination. And they're all, thanks to the varroa mite and also to pesticides and sprawl and all the, you know, many things that have happened to our countryside, they are all, for the most part, gone. There are a few survivor communities, but not enough to provide viable pollination. So beekeepers really have a role in it, and it's a role that's a lot more visible than it used to be.
Now, as you say several times in the book, you have to kind of be irrational to want to be a beekeeper. It's not something you go into for the money, and it's not something you go into because it's a pleasant job. But these beekeepers, they have, well, a lot of them are in it for multiple generations, but they have a kind of passion for this, which is amazing.
Yeah, they love what they do, and you don't become a beekeeper or stay a beekeeper for the money. There's just, you know, there's so many easier ways to make a buck, and a lot of times they don't make a buck. It's a very, you know, it's like farming is a really fickle career choice. Some years, you know, the weather, like this year in Santa Fe, I was speaking to a beekeeping group last night, and there's, you know, there's no nectar flowing. They're having a really hard time keeping their bees healthy and alive. So, you know, if you want a steady income, you go into software sales or insurance or something like that. So it's really, you know, we all, as a writer, I guess I felt a lot of kinship to John Miller because as a writer, I've also chosen a path that's not particularly remunerative or, it's very fulfilling, but I'm never going to make a lot of money doing it. If I wanted to make a lot of money, I would have done something else. But, you know, I don't get stung all the time, and I don't have to travel 8 months a year and, you know, drive semis and deal with all the crazy logistics of labor and machinery and bugs that these guys do. So, yeah, they do it because they love it. And, you know, John Miller also, obviously, it's in a business that he bought from his dad. It's the only thing he knows. So, you know, maybe there's something, you know, he says if he wasn't a beekeeper, he'd be a mortician. And he does have a obsession with death. But you just do it because the bees call you, and he just gets so excited every time he opens a beehive. And to see that, to witness that kind of passion, that's really why I wrote the book, is, you know, these people who do this really hard thing in an age of convenience when they could do so many other things with their lives.
Hannah Nordhaus is the author of the new book, The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and 500,000 Honeybees Help Feed America. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.